Democrats' issue of Spotlight. It's good night for now and bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran's foreign minister warns against the presence of Israeli and terrorist elements in the region as he arrives in Russia to meet with the country's officials. The Yemeni army says it has downed a Saudi spy drone in the central province of Ma'arib. Also ahead, the United States says the number of its active and inactive nuclear warheads stands at 3,750. Iran has called on Russia to remain cautious about the presence of Israeli and terrorist elements in the region. Iran's foreign minister said his country has expressed its concerns to Russian officials about the developments in the region that can threaten regional peace and stability. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Tehran is willing to significantly boost ties with Moscow. He made the remarks upon arrival in the Russian capital, where he is set to meet with the country's officials, including his counterpart Sergei Lavrov. Discussions on developments in the South Caucasus and Afghanistan will also be on the agenda. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says unilateral coercive measures, also called UCMs, are tantamount to terrorism.
Since UCMs mainly target ordinary people, such measures greatly contribute to the root causes of terrorism.
Majid Takht Ravanchi noted that the measures are undermining the efforts of targeted countries to counter terrorism. He added that the root causes of terrorism are socioeconomic problems as well as foreign military occupation and intervention. Iran's UN envoy stressed that the only way to combat terrorism is through international cooperation. Takht Ravanchi was speaking at the United Nations General Assembly's Sixth Commission concerning the fight against terrorism. The United States says it believes diplomacy is the best way to make sure Iran never acquires nuclear weapons. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan made the remarks during a meeting with his Israeli counterpart. Sullivan said President Joe Biden's administration has made clear that if diplomacy fails, the U.S. is prepared to turn to other options. This comes amid Israel's continued threats against Iran's interests, especially the Islamic Republic's nuclear program. On Tuesday, Israel's military chief said the regime will carry out further attacks on Iranian nuclear capabilities Tehran says it does not seek to acquire, develop, or use nuclear weapons, but will not hesitate to give a crushing response to any acts of aggression. Political commentator Mr. Scott Bennett says the Biden administration is not honest in its pledge to engage in diplomacy with Iran.
The claims of the Biden administration to engage in diplomacy is, of course, a camouflage and a cover, much as they utilized in the invasion of Iraq in 2003. So Iran is wise to meet these threats with a very calm and serene diplomatic posture that simply posits and presents to the rest of the world, is this what the world wants? Another global war that will no doubt bring in other nations such as China, such as Russia, such as Iran, such as Syria, such as Iraq. Is this what the world wants? A devastating war against Sunni Islam or Shia Islam? Is this what the world wants? Another mass exodus into Europe of refugees? And I don't think the world wants that. And I think the history of the Biden administration and the devastation that it's allowed in Afghanistan is another evidence of its senility and its inability to do any sort of coherent foreign policy or military policy.
The Yemeni army says it has downed the spy drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition in the country's central province of Ma'arib. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the aircraft was shot down by a surface-to-air missile in the Juba district. Saudi Arabia has launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015. Or since that time, that years-long war has so far killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions of others. The aggression has also targeted Yemen's vital infrastructure, leaving citizens there in utter misery. Six Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails keep up their hunger strike to protest against their administrative detention. Two of them have been transferred to a hospital over their deteriorating conditions. Our correspondent Mona Candil reports.
The hunger strike of six Palestinian prisoners who have refused to eat for days have once again brought the plight of Palestinian prisoners to attention. The six are on hunger strike to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them.
Israeli prison authorities refused to deal with the hunger strikers' legal demands. Kaid al-Fosfos has been on a hunger strike for over 82 days. Mehdad al-Ghawasmi for over 76 days, and both were transferred to Goplan Hospital. Ala al-Araj as well has been transferred to Al-Ramlis Clinic. Their health condition is deteriorating, but they insist to continue with their move to end their illegal detention.
In solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah. Here, every week, you'll see prisoners' mothers and wives holding the pictures of their beloved ones. They say they are the voice of the prisoners.
My son Mujahid went on a hunger strike and ended it after the Israeli authorities decided not to renew his administrative detention and to release him. Mujahid spent almost 10 years in jail and then he was rearrested after 15 months of release. His administrative detention has been renewed three times. That's why he started the open-ended hunger strike. I know he was risking his life, but that was only for the hope that he could be released to live with us, his family, and to raise his only child.
Administrative detention is illegal. However, it's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with 520 of them under the illegal administrative detention. Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoner follows the same path in the future. Unfortunately, Israel ends the administrative detention only when hunger-striking prisoners are on the verge of death. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The U.S. has published a number of nuclear warheads in its arsenal amid efforts to restart arms controls talks with Russia. According to the State Department, the U.S. military maintained over 3,700 active and inactive nuclear warheads. Washington has released the figure for the first time in 4 years following a blackout on the data imposed by former President Donald Trump. Last week, Russian and U.S. diplomats began talks aimed at reaching new arms control accords and find a successor to the new START treaty. The deal abandoned by Trump limits the number of nuclear warheads deployed by Moscow and Washington to 1,550. Democrat lawmakers in the U.S. Congress have warned against a looming downgrade in credit rating amid a continued deadlock over the country's debt limit. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer called the potential downgrade disastrous. He said too many Republicans were pushing Washington to the edge of default. The Treasury Secretary earlier said the crisis could trigger another recession. President Joe Biden also announced that Democrats are considering making an exception to a Senate rule to extend the government's borrowing limit without help from the Republicans. The stalemate came as the Republicans vowed to block a vote to raise the government's borrowing cap. If the deadlock holds, the U.S. will not have funds to meet its obligations to creditors and could default on its $28 trillion in debt by mid-October. NATO chief has criticized support for a parallel military alliance made up of troops from European Union member states. Jens Stoltenberg said the European-only force would risk dividing and weakening the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. He described NATO as the cornerstone for the security of the continent. This comes amid growing calls within the EU for a new coordinated military task force. Support has increased for the idea over the past months since Brussels was sidelined by Washington as the U.S. ended its military presence in Afghanistan. A recent security arrangement between the U.S., Britain, and Australia has further added to the chorus of voices calling for a European-only military force. Political commentator Michael Springman believes it is better for European countries to reduce their military reliance on the U.S.
Well, talking about Europe and its independence from the United States, to some extent that might be a good thing. On the other hand, the issue is, will we have an American Europe or a European Europe, as former French President Charles de Gaulle used to talk about? It would be good if Europe moved away from the United States and concentrated itself on its own destiny and its own culture and its own politics. However, we've seen Angela Merkel in Germany try to wrest control of Europe and move it in the direction of America and move it in the direction of opening the country and the continent up to waves of migrants.
The British government says the fuel crisis that hit the country in recent weeks is now over. Despite that, drivers in England's southeast are still complaining of long lines and empty forecourts. Amina Taylor has more from one of the worst-hit areas in the British capital.
This is a crisis that was said to have blown over. It was supposed to be a gradual return to full fuel tanks and drivers reassured that the very worst was behind them. Those in England's southeast continue to be hit especially hard. And despite army personnel now helping with the distribution of fuel to forecourts most in need, Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng denied the UK was at crisis point.
The last few days have been difficult. We've seen large queues. But I think the situation is stabilizing. We're getting petrol into the forecourts.
For consumers, the minister's words may well ring hollow.
I just think it's embarrassing that, again, we live in the UK, that we have to get the army to drive trucks. So, yeah, ridiculous. I think it's what we'll just get used to now, isn't it? I mean, that's just how it is. This government's terrible. Preceding governments have been just as bad. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah, this shouldn't be happening in the UK today.
You should bring in foreign help. I mean, workers from abroad who actually know how to drive lorries and to carry the fuel to the pumping stations.
UK is a very big country and very rich country and a developed country. All this mess should not be like in your life. since, like I said, since day one. So I really don't understand all this mess, really.
It should have been business as usual at these pumps, but for many drivers, they'll be wondering whether or not their reality is being matched by the rhetoric coming out of Downing Street, and worse still, if this is a shape of things to come.
The government had to admit that one of the solutions touted to alleviate the crisis, relaxing the visa rules for experienced EU HGV drivers, has underperformed.
What we said to the road haulage industry was, fine, give us the names of the drivers that you want to bring in, and we'll sort out the visas. We got another 5,000 visas. They only produced 127 names.
The worry is that this fuel issue becomes a crisis of confidence in Britain's ability to deliver the basics for its citizens. This might leave more of a damaging legacy than the government cares to admit. Amina Taylor, London.
And finally, Iran has sent a new round of humanitarian aid to Afghanistan as a humanitarian crisis looms over the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban has more from Kabul.
As the humanitarian crisis looms in Afghanistan, Iran's new shipment of humanitarian aid to Afghan people containing tons of foodstuffs has arrived in Kabul. This round of Iranian aid was handed over by Iranian Red Crescent Society in cooperation with its Afghan partner.
The Iranian Red Crescent Society, in cooperation with the Red Crescent Society of Afghanistan, has sent the first consignment, which is including the 15 metric tons of the humanitarian consignment, mainly the food items, including the rice, canned beans, and as well as the macaronis and other sugar and other food items which is necessary for the people in Afghanistan.
These aids are provided amid the rising hunger as a result of political crisis and the blockade of Afghans' assets by the U.S. Afghans and aid groups believe that the country wouldn't face the ongoing crisis if the U.S. had not frozen its assets.
We thank Iran and other countries who are helping Afghans these days. Our main concern is U.S. sanctions that are pushing people to unprecedented hunger and poverty. The U.S. and other countries must consider humanitarian needs and separate it from political issues. Many countries want to send money to the people of Afghanistan, but can't do that due to sanctions.
Our situation is really dire. I have lost my job and I don't receive my salary anymore. I urge international countries to help poor Afghan people who have nothing to eat these days. Some are displaced and live on the streets.
2 decades of war have left Afghanistan impoverished. The U.S.-led war in the country came to an end in August when all foreign forces left Afghanistan. Afghanistan is faced with a multitude of crises. Health clinics are closing down, while rampant inflation is treating people who have been left with little money and food. All that's against the backdrop of Afghanistan's frozen assets abroad. In such circumstances, assistance from the international community, especially the neighboring countries, will be a welcome relief for millions of Afghans. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Okay, Rahmatullah's report brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
this supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep, and hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The limelight.
Biden is continuing former President Donald Trump's policy of misusing Title 42 in violation of U.S. treaty obligations. The Title 42 program stems from a misapplication of an obscure public health law, the Public Health Service Act of 1944, says Marjorie Kahn, journalist, in an article titled "Biden's expulsion of Haitian migrants is racist, illegal, and Trumpian." Stay tuned for more. Notwithstanding President Joe Biden's promise to pursue a more humane immigration policy than his predecessor, the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, has been illegally expelling Haitian migrants, with the Border Patrol cracking whips and herding them like cattle. When U.S. authorities put them on a plane to Haiti, they chained them like animals, hands, feet, and waist. And once they arrived, they unchained them so journalists wouldn't see them, one Haitian man told John Oliver on Last Week Tonight. When confronted about his administration's use of horse reins as whips to menace black migrants at the southern U.S. border, Biden said it was horrible to see people treated like they did. Horses nearly running them over and people being strapped. It's outrageous. Biden's denial is reminiscent of that of Barack Obama, who reacted to the 6,700-page report of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence that documented a widespread program of U.S. torture by saying that torture is contrary to who we are. But like torture, vicious beatings of black people have been sanctioned by the state throughout U.S. history. The images of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, and Department of Homeland Security, DHS, agents on horseback whipping and assaulting Haitian refugees blatantly display the clear historical relationship between slavery and modern immigration policy, policing, and carceral state, the National Lawyers Guild said in a statement. Biden administration has expelled more than 4,600 Haitian migrants from the United States since September 19, conducting 43 flights from Del Rio, Texas to Haiti, which is still reeling from its recent devastating earthquake, flooding from a tropical storm, and a presidential assassination. Most of the people in Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince have no access to drinking water, electricity, or garbage collection. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, the International Organization for Migration, IOM, the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, and the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, call on states to refrain from expelling Haitians without a proper assessment of their individual protection needs and urge them to uphold fundamental human rights. In their statement, they cited the escalation of violence and insecurity in Haiti, noting that at least 19,000 people were internally displaced in Port-au-Prince during the summer of 2021. In addition, more than 20% of girls and boys have been victims of sexual violence, and nearly 24% of the population, over half of them children, live below the extreme poverty level of $1.23 per day. Nearly 46% of the population, about 4.4 million people, face acute food insecurity, and 1.2 million are at emergency levels, with 3.2 million people at crisis levels. The four organizations estimated that 217,000 Haitian children suffer from moderate to severe acute malnutrition. Expelling Haitian migrants to face these horrific conditions is not only cruel, it is also racist and illegal. The whipping of Haitians by mounted Border Patrol agents was spectacularly racist, but the use of Title 42 to expel asylum seekers is equally racist and illegal and much more damaging. Attorney Brian Kankanen, a board member at the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, told Truth Out. Indeed, on September 23rd, Daniel Foote, U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti, handed in his resignation to Secretary of State Antony Blinken, stating he will not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees from the U.S.-Mexico border. Foote called the U.S. policy toward Haiti deeply flawed. Biden is continuing former President Donald Trump's policy of misusing Title 42 in violation of U.S. treaty obligations. The Title 42 program stems from a misapplication of an obscure public health law, the Public Health Service Act of 1944. The act was designed to grant quarantine authority to health officials to expel any persons, including U.S. citizens who arrive from a foreign country. Title 42 was never intended to distinguish between non-citizens who could or could not be removed or expelled from the United States, according to Human Rights Watch. plaintiffs asserted that the Biden administration's use of Title 42 to deport migrants violates the Administrative Procedure Act, the Immigration and Nationality Act, and the Public Health Services Act. In granting the injunction, Judge Sullivan found that the plaintiffs were likely to prevail on the merits of their claim that the administration's use of Title 42, which has never been applied in the immigration context, is illegal. The judge agreed with the plaintiff's contention that nothing in Section 265 or Title 42 more generally purports to authorize any deportations, much less deportations in violation of statutory procedures and humanitarian protections, including the right to seek asylum. Judge Sullivan also concluded that plaintiffs would suffer irreparable harm if an injunction were not granted, because they would be sent to their home countries, which are among the most dangerous in the world due to gang, gender, family membership, and other identity-based violence. Finally, Judge Sullivan determined that a preliminary injunction would not harm the government, and it would promote public health to quickly process, quarantine, and regulate people who arrived at the border. He accepted the plaintiff's claim that the public interest requires the U.S. to refrain from wrongfully sending people to countries where they are likely to face substantial harm. But on September 30, a three-judge panel of D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals paused Judge Sullivan's injunction while it reviews Biden's appeal. As Lee Glarant, who filed a lawsuit on behalf of the ACLU, told CBS News, this is just the first step in appellate litigation. Nothing stops the Biden administration from immediately repealing this horrific Trump-era policy, Glarant said, adding, if the administration is making the political calculation that if it acts inhumanely now, it can act more humanely later, that calculation is misguided and of little solace to the families that are being sent to Haiti or brutalized in Mexico right now. The Title 42 policy violates the Refugee Convention, which grants non-citizens the right to asylum if they can demonstrate a well-founded fear of persecution due to race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion if they are sent back to their home countries. The Biden administration's use of Title 42 also violates the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment, which the U.S. has ratified. That treaty contains a non-refoulement provision. It forbids sending an individual to a country where there is a substantial likelihood he or she would be subject to torture. UNHCR has confirmed repeatedly during the pandemic that expelling asylum seekers and migrants at the border without an individualized determination of the need to protect them violates the non-refoulement provisions of international law. The UNHCR Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, Gillian Triggs, stated, "The right to seek asylum is a fundamental right. The COVID-19 pandemic provides no exception."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Number of events. From the outset of the 21st century, something happened, something dramatic, that set off a chain of unnatural events.
Islam in Russia, Part 1.
After more than a decade, no one is really sure who actually set off what transpired. Many researchers are still studying its mysterious and contradictory details. But in the meantime, the finger has been pointed at a population a billion strong, with one thing in common, Islam. Yes, it was the Muslim community of the world that was blamed by the mainstream media for the September 11th tragedy and what ensued. But the strange thing is that in the first decade of the 21st century, Muslims were the main victims of wars and terrorist attacks. Take Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, Lebanon, Myanmar, Bahrain, and recently, in one of the most catastrophic of these complicated wars, Syria. But while Muslims are being accused of disrupting world order, history shows that wherever in the world they have lived, they have left relics of order and human civilization behind. And while Muslims are being massacred in the most horrendous ways in Syria, a huge country like Russia is one of their few allies. Russia's culture, art, science, and politics have made their mark on history with many famous names. Great writers and brilliant literary works like Pushkin, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Chekhov, Crime and Punishment, War and Peace, Tchaikovsky, Shostakovich, ballets and memorable operas, Eisenstein, Pudovkin, the glorious cinema of the 1920s, Yuri Gagarin, Man on the Moon, famous names of the fluctuant history of this country, from the Viking and Mughal eras to the Tsarist period, and contemporaries like Marx, Lenin, socialism, communism, and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. But there are things in Russia that the world knows less about. Residing in the neighborhood of the Russian Federation, even I didn't know that in a country I have always known for its great achievements of human civilization, lives more than 30 million native non-immigrant Muslims, whose ancestors have been living in this part of the world generation after generation for the last 1,300 years, and played a crucial role in forming the history of the world's largest country. This is Russia, the largest country in the world. 17,075,400 square kilometers big. It includes all of Asia's north. And on the edge, between the east and the west, it joins Asia to Europe. The Russian Federation consists of 21 autonomous republics and two federal cities, Moscow and St. Petersburg. Here is the most southerly part of the Russian Federation, beside the Caspian Sea in the vicinity of Iran. The city is called Derbent. Derbent is located near Makhachkala, the capital of Dagestan. Historians suggest that this is the gate through which the religion Islam entered the territory, known today as the Russian Federation. Located between the Caspian Sea and the Monte Caucasus, the city of Derbent has been very important throughout history as the Caucasian territory's entrance. In the distant past, Derbent was seized by the powerful kings of the Sasanian Empire of Iran, and the city was named Derbent by the Sasanid king Horvat. In Pahlavi Persian, Derbent means a narrow passage. There is an assumption that the people of Derbent were converted to Islam by the invitation of the Prophet's disciples who were fighting in the Arab army. When I went to visit the ancient graveyard of Derbent, I saw the tombs attributed to the Prophet's disciples. It seems these tombs were proof for those who assumed such. The assumption is that upon passing through the Sasanian Empire, the Arab Muslims arrived in the north of Iran, and thus Islam spread into the northern parts of the Sasanian Empire, Derbent of today. At that time, the Caspian people resided in this region. The Caspians were the most powerful state of Eastern Europe. The Friday Mosque is the oldest in Russia, with the Caspians converting to Islam and Muslims settling in the town of Derbent in the 8th century, the construction of 7 mosques began. The last of these mosques was the Friday Mosque, that was built exclusively for Friday prayers. This mosque is more than 1,300 years old. In Russia, Islam was not limited to Derbent and the Caspian people. Islam had spread throughout Russia's entire southern regions. Then, in the 10th century, it reached the central regions of today's Russia. This is the city of Kazan, capital of the Republic of Tatarstan. Located between the Ural Mountains and the Volga River, Kazan is the city of mosques and churches. Muslims and Christians have been living here together for centuries. Today, in the vicinity of Kazan city, the remains of an ancient town are being kept as a museum. The city of Volga, Bulgaria, is on the banks of the Volga River. It has become a headquarters for a vast Islamic empire. Ibn Fazlan, an Arab explorer and travel writer, entered Volga, Bulgaria in 1922. Ibn Fazlan was the Muslims' caliphate envoy, and his mission was to present Islam to Amish, the king of Volga, Bulgaria. Before the arrival of Ibn Fazlan, the people of this region had already become familiar with Islam through their relations with Muslim merchants, so they readily accepted his message. Promoting Islam among other communities, the Bulgarians invited the mighty king of Kiev to accept Islam. History states Vladimir, who was looking for a religion for the Russians at the same time, asks the Bulgarian envoys about the traits of Islam. They answer that this is a religion that forbids eating pork and drinking alcohol. It's been said that for this reason, Vladimir does not accept Islam and answers, "Alcoholic drinks are cheerful for Russians and we can't live without them." In the end, Vladimir endorsed Christianity as the official religion of Russians in 988 AD. In 1237, Mughals and Tatars seized Volga, Bulgaria, and this state perished. Then the Golden Horde was established here. The Golden Horde was part of the Mughal Empire under the rule of Batu Khan, the grandchild of Genghis. The Golden Horde's kingdom consisted of the main parts of today's Russia, Kazakhstan, and Ukraine. It is unknown what the Golden Horde title refers to, but some sources state that Batu Khan had a large tent with golden pillars, and the Golden Horde was named after this tent. After the establishment of the Golden Horde, the Chengizian Code of Tolerance helped Muslims perform their religious duties with ease. After Uzbek Khan's accession and conversion to Islam, Islam became the official religion of the Golden Horde and began to spread quickly. The Islamic civilization circulated in the fields of southern Russia, and the cities of the Golden Horde were filled with clergymen, schools, and mosques. The golden age of the Golden Horde lasted 2 centuries. The Golden Horde's king's reputation for justice and their tolerance for other religions also spread to all Islamic states. But when Timur invaded the Qichak fields in the Golden Horde's kingdom and the ruins it had caused, the state was demolished and was broken down into different khanates. After Timur's army began marching on Moscow, the people of the city restored Kazan, and the Khanate of Kazan that earlier was part of the Golden Horde became an independent and powerful state. Kazan was the most affluent Khanate among the split regions of the Golden Horde, a state that had made significant economic and commercial advances in which the influences of the Islamic civilization were apparent. The Kazan city of today is in the territory of these modern Khanates. Kazan is a green and lively city on the banks of the fertile Volga River, and it has been one of the main settlements of the Muslims of Russia throughout history. Manifestations of the Muslim cultural heritage in this town are famous mosques like Hol Sharif, Marjani, and Apianevsky, all of which have a unique history and architecture. From the middle of the 15th century, with the rising of the dynasty of Russia, the Russian princes began their efforts for independence from Mongolian rule. Eventually, in 1480, Ivan III refused to accept the rule of the Mongols and wrenched back a vast part of Russia from Mongolian rule. A few years later, the Great Invasion took place. In the summer of 1552, an army of 150,000 men belonging to Ivan Grozny, historically known as Ivan the Terrible, invaded Kazan. The town was besieged by Russian aggressors. The October of that year coincided with Ramadan, the fasting month of the Muslims. Although they could have stayed alive by surrendering and giving them privileges, the Kazan defenders fought for Kazan until the last moment. Many Muslims were killed when the town was seized, including Sayyid Hol Sharif, the religious leader of the Tatars. Fighting for the resistance of Kazan until the last moment of his life, in the end he was thrown from the roof of his school by the Russian aggressors. Years later, in memory of Sayyid Hol Sharif's resistance, Russia's largest mosque was named after him. The Russians too, after massacring Muslims in Kazan and seizing their town, built the St. Bastille Church in Moscow in honor of their victory.
In the limelight. However horrifying the January 6th riot at the US Capitol appeared in the moment, we now know that it was far worse. The country was hours away from a full-blown constitutional crisis, not primarily because of the violence and mayhem inflicted by hundreds of President Donald Trump's supporters, but because of the actions of Donald Trump himself. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, January 6th Was Worse Than We Knew. The editorial board is a group of opinion journalists whose views are informed by expertise, research, and debate. Thank you. However horrifying the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol appeared in the moment, we now know that it was far worse. The country was hours away from a full-blown constitutional crisis, not primarily because of the violence and mayhem inflicted by hundreds of President Donald Trump's supporters, but because of the actions of Donald Trump himself. In the days before the mob descended on the Capitol, a corollary attack, this one bloodless and legalistic, was playing out down the street in the White House, where Mr. Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and a lawyer named John Eastman huddled in the Oval Office, scheming to subvert the will of the American people by using legal sleight of hand. John Eastman's unusual visit was reported at the time, but a new book by the Washington Post journalists Bob Woodward and Robert Costa provides the details of his proposed six-point plan. It involved Vice President Mike Pence rejecting dozens of already certified electoral votes representing tens of millions of legally cast ballots, thus allowing Congress to install Donald Trump in a second term. Mike Pence ultimately refused to sign on, earning him the rage of Donald Trump and chants of "Hang Mike Pence" by the rioters, who erected a makeshift gallows on the National Mall. The fact that the scheme to overturn the election was highly unlikely to succeed is cold comfort. Donald Trump remains the most popular Republican in the country. Barring a serious health issue, the odds are good that he will be the party's nominee for president in 2024. He also remains as incapable of accepting defeat as he has ever been, which means the country faces a renewed risk of electoral subversion by Donald Trump and his supporters. Only next time, they will have learned from their mistakes. That leaves all Americans who care about preserving this republic with a clear task: reform the federal election law at the heart of Mr. Eastman's twisted ploy and make it as hard as possible for anyone to pull a stunt like that again. The Electoral Count Act, which passed more than 130 years ago, was Congress's response to another dramatic presidential dispute, the election of 1876, in which the Republican Rutherford Hayes won the White House despite losing the popular vote to his Democratic opponent, Samuel Tilden. After Election Day, Samuel Tilden led in the popular vote and in the Electoral College, but the vote in three southern states, South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana, was marred by accusations of fraud and intimidation by both political parties. Various officials in each state certified competing slates of electors, one for Rutherford Hayes and the other one for Samuel Tilden. The Constitution said nothing about what to do in such a situation, so Congress established a 15-member commission to decide which electors to accept as valid. The commission consisted of 10 members of Congress, evenly divided between the two political parties, and 5 Supreme Court justices, 2 appointed by Democrats and 3 appointed by Republicans. Rutherford Hayes, the Republican candidate, won all the disputed electors, including one from Oregon, by an 8-7 vote, giving him victory in the Electoral College by just a single vote. Democrats were furious and began to filibuster the counting process, but they eventually accepted Rutherford Hayes' presidency in exchange for the withdrawal of the last remaining federal troops from the South, ending Reconstruction and beginning the era of Jim Crow, which would last until the middle of the 20th century. It was obvious that Congress needed clearer guidelines for deciding disputed electoral votes. In 1887, the Electoral Count Act became law, setting out procedures for the counting and certifying of electoral votes in the states and in Congress. but the law contains numerous ambiguities and poorly drafted provisions. For instance, it permits a state legislature to appoint electors on its own, regardless of how the state's own citizens voted, if the state failed to make a choice on election day. But what does that mean? The law doesn't say. It also allows any objection to a state's electoral votes to be filed as long as just one senator and one member of the House put their names to it, triggering hours of debate, which is how senators like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley were able to gum up the works on 6th of January. A small minority of legal scholars have argued that key parts of the Electoral Count Act are unconstitutional, which was the basis of John Eastman's claim that Mike Pence could simply disregard the law and summarily reject electors of certain key battleground states. Nothing in the Constitution or federal law gives the Vice President this authority. The job of the Vice President is to open the envelopes and read out the results, and nothing more. Any reform of the Electoral Count Act should start there, by making it explicit that the Vice President's role on 6th of January is purely ministerial and doesn't include the power to rule on disputes over electors. The law should also be amended to allow states more time to arrive at a final count, so that any legal disputes can be resolved before the electors cast their ballots. The failed election provision should be restricted to natural disasters or terrorist attacks, and even then, it should be available only if there is no realistic way of conducting the election. Remember that in 2012, election was held just days after Hurricane Sandy lashed the East Coast, and yet all states were able to conduct their elections in full. This is another good argument for universal mail-in voting, which doesn't put voters at the mercy of the weather. The key point is that a close election, even a disputed election, is not a failed election. Finally, any objection to a state's electoral votes should have to clear a high bar. Rather than just one member of each chamber of Congress, it should require the assent of one quarter or more of each body. The grounds for an objection should be strictly limited to cases involving clear evidence of fraud or widespread voting irregularities. The threats to a free and fair presidential election don't come from Congress alone. Since 6th of January, Republican-led state legislatures have been clambering over one another to pass new laws making it easier to reject their own voters' will, and removing or neutralizing those officials who could stand in the way of a naked power grab, like Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, like he did when he resisted Donald Trump's personal plea to find just enough extra votes to flip the outcome in Georgia. How to ensure that frivolous objections are rejected while legitimate ones get a hearing? One approach would be to establish a panel of federal judges in each state to hear any challenges to the validity or accuracy of the state's election results. If the judges determine that the results are invalid, they would lay out their findings in writing and prevent the state from certifying the results. There is plenty more to be done to protect American elections from being stolen through subversion, like mandating the use of paper ballots that can be checked against reported results. Ideally, fixes like these would be adopted promptly by bipartisan majorities in Congress to convey to all Americans that both political parties are committed to a fair, transparent, and smooth vote-counting process. But for that to happen, the Republican Party would need to do a U-turn. Right now, some Republican leaders in Congress and the states have shown less interest in preventing election sabotage than in protecting and, in some cases, even venerating the saboteurs. Democrats should push through these reforms now and eliminate the filibuster if that's the only way to do so. If they hesitate, they should recall that a majority of the Republican caucus in the House, 139 members to be exact, along with 8 senators, continue to object to the certification of electoral votes even after the mob stormed the Capitol building. Time and distance from